I was speaking to the tendency of the popular media to perceive narratives of Indian women's sexuality via the lens of oppression. Now, of course, sexual violence against women is an important concern in India, as it is worldwide. But telling the story of violence against women misses the story of how women desire, which is what I wanted to highlight. What struck me from reading the responses from these psychoanalytic interviews that I did was just how much women adapted their eros to their circumstances. And so particularly the older women that I interviewed, those who were older than 35, didn't feel very oppressed, even as they narrated experiences and circumstances that sounded oppressive to me. Now, of course, if these were patients instead of the psychoanalytic interviews that they wore, one might wait for a kind of realization of oppression. But I wanted to see how psychoanalysis could be useful in mapping how eros leaks within a framework where oppression is internalized, as it was for many of my interviewees. And what I found very interesting was some of the imaginative ways that women found to satisfy their sexual desires while still maintaining community belonging. And viewed from the outside, these can look like oppressive forms of hypocrisy or enactments. But within the frame of these women's lives, it seemed like they had found some creative ways of making eros central and also of having eros and grieving it at the same time in order to move forward.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. We've been talking to elders in our field, people who've been practicing for 50 plus years, and they share with us how they view this field evolving and where they see it going. We also talk to clinicians who had professions prior to becoming psychoanalysts, and they share with us their journeys to doing what they now love. These are just samplings of the psychoanalysts we've been talking with, again, from all corners of the globe. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Amritha Narayanan. Dr. Narayanan has written a book entitled Women's Sexuality and Modern India in a Rapture of Distress. And the theme of the book has to do with women's sexual agency as it exists in India, both in the past and in the present. And by sexual agency, she defines it as the experience of bodily desire accompanied by the power to realize that desire. And we take up this issue of sexual agency throughout Indian culture, and she uses two methods to bring this material forward. First is she does lengthy interviews with people, with women who share both their sexual behaviors and their sexual imaginings. And she's also an analyst, and she is able to give us latent material as it emerges in the analytic setting. Some of the topics we touch on are the cultural influences, both on women's sexuality in India, and also how psychoanalysis is practiced. The meanings of sympathy for women and what it means to see a woman as oppressed. And we touch base on her thoughts about the Me Too movement as well. She distinguishes Indian feminism from international feminism. And we also talk about, towards the end, unusual sexual practices that are culturally influenced and how she understands it. Dr. Narayanan is a clinical psychologist and, as I say, also a psychoanalyst. And she has a longstanding interest in how cultures shape sexuality and clinical psychoanalysis. She's an essayist. She has written widely on sexuality, and she has a monthly column called Sexual Politics for a newspaper, the Deccan Herald. She has a clinical practice, and she is also a visiting professor of English in New Delhi, where she teaches both psychoanalysis at the undergraduate and the master's level. It was a fascinating pleasure for me to read her work and to really have my eyes opened to how culturally different things are, as she describes it, in the Indian geography, but also to learn about the Indian analysts who are practicing there and how much they have to contribute and enlarge our vision of our work, and both that as applies to their culture and our culture as well. I hope you enjoy it as I do. Amritha, welcome to the podcast. So good to have you.
Thanks, Harvey. It's good to be here.
You have focused a good deal of your professional work on the study and care of women patients, with particular focus on their sexuality. And you've written, you've lectured. And your latest book, which will be the focus of our conversation today, is entitled Women's Sexuality and Modern India in a Rapture of Distress, which is quite an engaging title. And to this book, you bring two skill sets of yours, one of which is you're a long-form interviewer. You meet women, select women, and talk to them at great length about their inner sexual life, their behavioral life. And in addition to that, you're an analyst, so you have access to latent material on these various subjects, which is also in the book and which we will also discuss. And I just want to let you know that one of the pleasures I had in reading this book is I can't recall the last time I've encountered a text where you so seamlessly integrate ancient Indian texts with modern psychoanalytic texts, that's for starters. Not only that, but the psychoanalytic references you bring forward are of the familiar Western authors and, to many of us, unfamiliar Indian authors, which is a real treat for us to begin to discover that world. And on top of that, you also bring forward the fiction canon, again, from the Western and Indian cultures. So reading this book is not only about the content of female sexuality, but it's like an immersion in the Indian world as it juxtaposes itself against what we're going to, I guess, call the Western world. So thank you for that. It's a real treat. I want to begin by reading a brief paragraph from page 2 in order to orient the listener to what we're about to dive into. And I'll leave it at that, and I'll start and I'll by quoting you as saying, "My education had trained me to listen for pain, illness, and oppression, overriding questions of difference. But along the way, I had become, dare I say it, less interested in health and equality and more interested in difference. How did women find sexual agency, the experience of bodily desire, accompanied by the power to realize that desire, under conditions of inequality? What are the diverse inner processes by which different women constitute themselves as sexual subjects and agents? It is hard to arrive at these questions because to write about the sexual agency of, quote, unfree female bodies in the Indian geography is to dialogue with the international imagination whose fantasies of, quote, woman and of, quote, India tend to cast Indian women as stars of an oppression plot. Now, if one wanted to summarize what I understand your thesis, it is to identify this oppression plot and to, in identifying it, walk away from it and develop alternatives. But why don't you start us off? Tell us, unpack that very rich paragraph, and then we'll talk about your methodology.
Okay. Thanks for having me here. That particular paragraph, I use the word plot there in the sense of a form given to a story. And I was speaking to the tendency of the popular media to perceive narratives of Indian women's sexuality via the lens of oppression. Now, of course, sexual violence against women is an important concern in India, as it is worldwide. But telling the story of violence against women misses the story of how women desire, which is what I wanted to highlight. What struck me from reading the responses from these psychoanalytic interviews that I did was just how much women adapted their eros to their circumstances. And so particularly the older women that I interviewed, those who were older than 35, didn't feel very oppressed, even as they narrated experiences and circumstances that sounded oppressive to me. Now, of course, if these were patients instead of the psychoanalytic interviews that they wore, one might wait for a kind of realization of oppression. But I wanted to see how psychoanalysis could be useful in mapping how eros leaks within a framework where oppression is internalized, as it was for many of my interviewees. And what I found very interesting was some of the imaginative ways that women found to satisfy their sexual desires while still maintaining community belonging. And viewed from the outside, these can look like oppressive forms of hypocrisy or enactments. But within the frame of these women's lives, it seemed like they had found some creative ways of making eros central, and also of having eros and grieving it at the same time in order to move forward. And so I wanted to theorize a bit about what women do given unfree conditions, but I wanted to theorize it in a way that was not divisive. So because if we think of women as free and unfree, then it can easily become positivistic. We know with the free people helping the unfree people to be just like them. And I think we lose some diversity. And one of the things I like about psychoanalysis is the capacity it gives us to hold difference. So if we look a little deeper, then we don't have to say things like the younger you are, the less sexual oppression you have. But we can sort of look in a breadthwise way instead of a linear way. And that's what I tried to do.
There's so much you've just said. You've referenced the age differences that have some influence on development. That would be true anywhere in the world, but the impression I have from reading your work is that it has a particular meaning in India, which I'm going to ask you about. You also made the distinction between being the individual and belonging to a community. Again, universal challenges, but the impression I have is that the demands of the community, as you described it, have a different kind of weight than maybe some of our, or many of our listeners are familiar with. So we'll get to that, but can you walk us through how you selected these women, who they are, who they aren't, what their backgrounds are, what gave them the freedom? Because some of the conversations are remarkably frank.
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised at how much they wanted to talk. So the way I recruited women to my study, is I started off, I was doing a lecture series in Ahmedabad, which is a small town in Gujarat, what we call a Tier 2 Indian city. And I announced at the end of my lecture series that I was doing these interviews about women's sexuality and looking for volunteers. And I got 6 volunteers who, a few of them were at that series and the rest were referred from the ones who were at the series. The only question I asked was tell me about your sexuality. And then sometimes I'd prompt for more interviews and more information. And that's why I call it psychoanalytic interviews, because I didn't provide a lot of guidance. I just provided open listening. And I did altogether 12 interviews. 6 were in Ahmedabad and the rest were in Mumbai and Bangalore. And they took between 10 and 30 hours.
That's a long interview, yeah.
Yeah. People took time to get into it, they wanted to speak with me, but it took time to get to all the material they wanted to say. But again, this time was not something I had in mind at the outset. It was sort of set by the first 3-4 women that I spoke with who asked for more time. And as a consequence, I ended up offering more time to everyone, which provided some real richness to the interviews. In terms of the demographic, they were all reasonably educated. They all had at least an undergraduate degree. And they were all middle class, which probably means they were upper middle class, because upper middle class Indians like to describe themselves as middle class. They were in the birth years 1950 to 1992. So two things about this. The first is that interviewing educated upper middle class women was part of the point, because this is a group that's thought to be free from some of the groupism that characterizes Indian life, and also free from some of the so-called oppression that characterizes Indian patriarchy. The imagination is that somewhat educated upper middle class women are free of this. And so I wanted to kind of check how true that was. The other thing that's interesting is the birth years. The 1950 to 1992 is sort of an interesting period in India's history. It's post-independence, which was 1947. So the British colonial influence is no longer a part of the government, though it continues to turn in our social lives. And between 1950 and 1992, there is no Western media allowed in India. So it's kind of a closed economy. It is a closed economy. And the amount of influence from the outside Western world is limited. And so I think it makes for a particularly crystallized space of some of these things I talk about.
The religious distribution in your sample?
There were 10 Hindu women and 1 Muslim and 1 Christian woman. This was mostly chances, fairly random.
Did they either describe themselves, or did you have a sense that their religious affiliation was a central part of their life?
I didn't. None of them talked about religious affiliation as a central part of their lives. However, there was this word culture kept coming up in the conversations, and there seemed to be strong religious elements, but experienced in a cultural or somewhat secular way that percolated through these narratives.
And because some of the examples you give are of the culture / religious context being restrictive. You know, you can't wear this clothing, or you can't go out with that person. Does that characterize the relationship with their cultural / religion?
Well, what we know from the empirical studies is that kind of restriction for young girls and women's sexuality is common across religions in India. That's what the empirical studies say. I think also that religion promotes it, certainly Hinduism. I can speak for, since most of the women were Hindus, I think Hinduism, at least in the way that it's culturally interpreted, does promote some of that restrictiveness. Now, of course, it's possible to have a wider ranging reading of the religion. And one can do that. And then of course, you'll find plenty of loopholes and exceptions, which I wish people would do more of. And I think the women also wanted to do more of. So I have a few examples in the book of how women kind of complain that some of the biggest blockbuster Hindu myths, if you will, don't represent women's sexuality in all its diversity. They represent a very narrow view. And many of the women I spoke to wished that, you know, a figure like Draupadi, who has five husbands, could be the blockbuster woman ideal, which it's not. So there was some interface, some conversation, I would say, between mythology, literature that comes from religious and semi-religious mythology, and the women's experience of restrictiveness. Hmm. But rather than from the religion, then they connected, of course, to the parents and to the family. Hmm. Yeah.
I think it's fair to say that most religions, in their more fundamentalist leanings, almost by definition, are attempting to restrict sexuality. Hmm. West and East.
Women's in particular?
Certainly women's in particular, yeah. Yes. That's my sense of the Western version of that.
Yeah.
Let me jump into something that you've written, which is, again, one of the many themes of the book. I want to read what you've written on sympathy. Quote, "Sympathy denies the agency and the choices of its object. Such sympathy, if strong, unconsciously repeats the most familiar form of psychological misogyny. It refuses to recognize women's sexual agency by casting women as suffering victims, and it offers women an emotional reward in the form of attention for participating in this casting. If women experience pity as a reward, a form of attention that feels pleasurable, they may unconsciously trade silence about their sexual pleasures and agency in exchange for pity, reinforcing the oppression plot." Well, can you say more about that?
Yes. Well, anecdotally, when I traveled outside of India as well as within India, there's this feeling of a kind of a general feeling of pity for Indian women and the hardship that Indian women endure from Indian men. And I think the nationwide anti-rape protests of 2012 sort of furthered this idea that Indian women are very oppressed. When I started doing the reading for this book, I realized that it's not just anecdotal, because there's also empirical psychology researchers like Baumeister and Twins, whom I talk about a bit in the book, who conclude that the Western world has, quote-unquote, defeated sexual suppression by virtue of the sexual revolution. And so my reading of some of these anecdotal experiences, as well as this research finding that the Western world has defeated sexual suppression, I suggest that there's an unconscious sexual politics afoot, a kind of competitiveness between nations that extends to sexuality, in which something of the national ego ideal is posited as the best model of sexuality. So choice and openness could be, you know, one example of this. And in the Indian example would be discretion and secrets, and of course, the performance of restrictiveness for women. So between these gazes upon Indian women's sexuality, there's a tendency to feel sorry for women. And I've noticed in public spaces as well as in the space of a psychotherapy clinic that if you do attend to that, then one can get very stuck in mourning. Now, we know that mourning is pretty critical, but there's a way in which mourning can cover up eros. And this is what I was keen to avoid, both in my reading of the women's stories, as well as, of course, in my clinical experience.
You mention how each nation, culture, presents itself as the epitome of correct sexuality, whatever any of that means. You have a wonderful sentence in the book concerning modesty, and it sounds to me that this would apply more to the Indian culture than the Western culture, though I'd be interested in your take on it. You write, "Modesty is described as a form of adornment, appealing in the very confidence it refuses, and meek looks are a form of sexual signaling. Mm-hmm. That's not unknown in the West, certainly. But do you think, I mean, you spend time in the States, you live in India. What's your sense on this, quote, modesty, the adorning type of modesty?
Well, of course, a lot of this varies by generation. And yet, I found that in some of the women I talked to, there was a preference for modesty. And in an odd turn, this made them a bit against a sexual revolution type of ideology, which would make it kind of more promiscuous displays of sexuality all right. I think modesty holds a really deep importance in Indian culture. It's written into the law. For example, the law on sexual harassment, the IPC 354, instead of saying you shouldn't harass women, the crime is outraging the woman's modesty.
Huh.
As if the language of the law suggests, sorry.
No, that's a beautiful description of just what we're saying.
Yeah. As if women are naturally modest, and then the harassment outrages modesty, and so modesty is sort of normal to the female condition, and that's built into the language of the law, which goes to show that it's pretty deep. And so there's a real diversity of responses to that. So modesty has a great importance for women who find it, some women who find it very beautiful. They find it a source of continuity and connection with their mothers, because this is, of course, a more antique value system and way of dressing and being. But some women experience it as an injunction, as a form of oppression, and feel upset about the extent to which it's imposed upon them. So there's a real diversity of responses. But within that, I still can say that either you hate it or you're into it, but it's important.
Yeah. Do you have information from men about how they experience the modest adornment?
I don't. But women, speaking about men, which I do have as part of my book, they often describe their men's enjoyment of their modesty and their kind of attunement that the men have when things are not obvious, when there's something enigmatic about signaling or dressing, and that there's a pleasure in that. And if you watch Indian movies, Bollywood movies, which I'm sure you've probably experienced, that also is sometimes reproduced. It's happening a bit less now, but the beauty and the enjoyment of the experience of shyness on both sides in a heterosexual coupling, it's very vivid.
Mm. Well, there's much in the book that draws our attention to the Indian versus the what you call the international perspective. And one paragraph I wanted to ask you about has to do with different versions of feminism. You write, "For most of the 20th century, the excess of sympathy in the Western gaze towards Indian women has been the basis of a rift between Indian and international feminisms. Indian feminism has had a long-standing project of resisting the projections involved in the imagined monolithic imperialist gaze as much as it has a project of resisting the male gaze." Let me read that again. Mm-hmm. "Indian feminism has had a long-standing project of resisting the projections involved in the imagined monolithic imperialistic gaze as much as it has a project of resisting the male gaze." So help me us out. Share with us the monolithic imperialist gaze and the male gaze and the imagined quality that you highlight in both.
I think that it's important that self-defining as Indian became important at the same time as self-defining women's sexuality, you know, women's individual sexuality. And so there was a bit of a conflict there between, on one hand, wanting to place women's sexuality ahead of this fight against colonialism, but this pushback that happens, and I quote this woman politician, Sarojini Naidu, who was very instrumental in getting Indian women the vote, and who says that we have to be careful of all those who come in the guise of friendship to interpret India to their world and exploit their weaknesses and expose the secrets of home. I found this to be such a laden and suspicion-laden comment. And I do think that this, the idea that there has been the imposition of a colonial English/Western imagination upon India prior to 1950 in a very concrete way, I think that played an important role in how India started to define its sexual politics. The male gaze, which is common to all cultures, fighting that became secondary, or asserting women's sexual rights in relationship to how women are needed to be controlled under patriarchy, that took a second place to fighting colonialism, to engendering a bit of reticence in talking about Indian women's issues outside, to people outside India. And so I think this caused a delay, if you will, in how we approached the question of sexuality under Indian feminism. So if you look at a book like The History of Doing, which is a history of Indian feminism, the idea of women's sexuality is not there at all, except in terms of safety from violence. Women's sexual desires as a theme is completely absent from this book, which was published in 92 or so. It's only after that, and really in the last two decades, that talking about sexuality became acceptable. And I think there was this concern that to not sort of sell out India to the Western world, to try and settle this by ourselves, which is what I mean when I say it caused a fracture between Indian feminism and feminism in the West. It seemed like there was a concern that Western women, feminists, might step in and say, look, you're not very free and you're oppressed. I think that concern made us, or Indian feminists, a bit hesitant. And I think there's some good reason for that, not related to general suspicion, but related to what I think is a very important concern for Indian feminism, which is that we proceed together as a group rather than some people get ahead. And I think that women, which is feminism generally also, but I think there was a fear that if sexual freedom became, you know, the thing, then people who had adapted to sex under patriarchy would be behind people who were now coming into the world, women who are younger, for example. And so how to hold Indian women, old and young, how to hold all these sexualities, the diversity of these sexualities, without causing a fracture within the women, without saying that, oh, some people have it better than others. And I think they were very hesitant to do that, and also given the diversity of needs.
Well, central to this is the family. Yeah. And what the family communicates, and you spend time on that as well. And if I may, I'm going to ask you to read, this is thoughts about how the parents can either really help or otherwise the developing girl's excitement and sexuality on page 14, if you could start us off.
Yeah. Cumulative trauma is what happens when, due to external events, a parent is unable to play a psychologically protective role. what the psychoanalyst Masood Khan calls an auxiliary ego function towards his or her child. So protection and permission for sexual excitement and aggression are necessary for sexuality to be nurtured and for eros to be available for the adult. But at a time when a child's capacity to manage excitement, to decide what excitements are permissible, and at the time where the child's capacity is immature and unstable, the parent needs to step in the role of an auxiliary. But until recently in India, social factors made caregivers uncomfortable or unable to provide an auxiliary ego function for girls' sexuality. My interviews suggest that for most parents, it was too difficult to provide a nourishing environment for girlish excitement. So the kind of psychosexual swaggering and showing off that's necessary to nurture excitement in the developmental stage of childhood, parents weren't able to provide that because they were diverted from their protective responsibilities as individuals through their unconscious internalization of the group norms of the patriarchal community that in India for centuries has used the control of female sexuality as a psychological scaffolding for the community psyche.
And I imagine what you're describing is that when a parent, perhaps particularly the father to a young girl, sees that swagger in his daughter, he doesn't appreciate its developmental, progressive, experimental, playful aspects, but immediately jumps to his own fantasies of promiscuity and then shuts it down. And the mother offers no counterweight to that.
Yes.
Is that a fair character? Yeah.
I would say it's particularly the mother's, however, because again, what the research tells us is that worldwide, mothers have more of a say in socialization of gender and sexuality. And particularly in India, the mothers play the role of shutting down the daughters' excitements, fathers as well, but particularly mothers. Mm. And so unfortunately, it gets duked out, if you will, in the mother-daughter relationship.
Mm. You do have some comments about fathers, and let me jump to them because they're important. You write, in the psychoanalytic story, for a girl to feel that her aggression is welcomed as natural, she needs the presence and availability of her father in early life as an object of love and identification. As much as the mother's body is the site of erotic love, where identification is built, so is the father's, though the latter is far less discussed. The documented absence of fathers in early child rearing for generations of Indians has impacted women's experience of aggression as a form of identification. Yeah. I hadn't appreciated, and that may be true for many listeners, about how absent fathers were in the early rearing of children in India. That had certainly been the case here in the States, though it's also changing, I would say, in the last generation here in the States. Fathers are very involved, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. I don't know how that is or isn't analogous to your situation.
It's also changing here, and which is very good news. And definitely more and more studies are coming up in the last decade or so that a new generation of middle-class Indian fathers are stepping forward and taking on these roles. But for the cohort that I'm talking about, between the birth years 1950 and 1992, the father is still very absent. His body is absent. It's absent in early life, and it's absent in adolescence. There's this painful moment of feeling a almost violent separation from the father's body. Hmm. That begins in early puberty, that many of the women described, and a profound sense of loss associating with the father's kind of anxious distancing in early adolescence.
You make an additional comment about the role of the father, which is one that, again, is familiar in the discourse here in the West. You write, for the Indian boy, the father is less a rival than an ally in the encounter with the overpowering maternal feminine. And that's been widely written about here in the States. There's a phase called the dyadic phallic phase that Peter Blow Sr. wrote about in his well-studied book, Son and Father, or Father and Son. It's one or the other, but it's an important work where he really establishes that sons and fathers are far more than just rivals, that there's a whole identification process that takes place, which is what I understand you to be saying as well, that the father has to be present for identification.
Yes, but that he makes himself more available for identification with the boy than with his girl child. And that the mother doesn't provide some what she should, and that is changing, of course, which is a similar kind of Oedipal alliance that allows the girl child also to feel not overpowered by the patriarchal network in which she lives. Instead, the mother, in many of the narratives, encourages the young girl into these narratives rather than pulling her out of them. So that helping hand from an older woman figure, some of the women had it. They had it either from their mothers or from other women outside the family. But the absence of that helping hand, the one that says that, yes, this is a restrictive environment, but you can still have the kind of excitement that you have. You can express the kind of sexuality that you want. I think there's a real sense of loss around that, which in turn sets up a divisiveness, a kind of excessive competitiveness between women.
I think that's a wonderful characterization, the helping hand, because that's in relation to the patriarchy you're describing, and also the community pressures, indeed the religious cultural pressures.
Yes.
That you're saying the mother can be there saying, yes, that is true, but you are you and I am you and I will support you and we are similar and we are different, but we are strong together.
Yes, and this is just a performance. The best mother has said, this is just a performance, whatever you're doing for the community. It's not real, but we really see a difference there that some of the mothers really felt this is real. It's ultimately important. And others were more relaxed about it.
And if one had to come up with a phrase to characterize what meaningful analytic work is, it would be to help people recognize within themselves how much of their life they've been living in performance mode and to, in getting some distance from that, discover what's truly inside themselves. Before we go to your clinical case, I'd like to touch upon the topic of the Me Too movement, which is present in what you're writing. And if I could ask you to read the bottom of page 51, just a few sentences there.
In the aftermath of Me Too, as women spoke more and more about how male sexual agency had been made entitled by social and institutional frameworks, the conversation about women's sexual agency faded to the backdrop. The monologues on injuries to women's eros that took over had a silencing effect. In the political climate of hashtag MeToo, it had in some ways become more forbidden than ever to talk about women's sexual desires. Outrage over what men have taken has reinforced the taboo on what and whom women would like to take.
Now, when I read that, I read it again just to make sure I was reading it right, because it is so unusual to see that written. It is clearly an attempt to rebalance what you feel has been imbalanced. But to be careful in this, it is not to deny the importance of shining a bright light on power differential and how that can be abusive and oppressive. So why don't you flesh this out, but include that piece in your thinking so someone would not misunderstand you, sure.
I mean, hashtag MeToo was important. It was necessary to point out how sexual violations happen when power gets concentrated in men's hands. I just wanted to point out that it was also problematic, particularly in the timing of it in India. It was the timing of it was around the same time as it was becoming, or it had a chance of becoming acceptable to talk a little bit more openly about women's sexual desires. I think that the difficulty with hashtag MeToo is that it legitimized a certain kind of narrative in which talking about the oppressive and abusive nature of male desire became not just acceptable, but almost compulsory. Mm-hmm. And I think particularly in a country like India, where there hasn't been a sexual revolution, where it's taboo to talk about women's sexual desires, we have to think about what happens then under those circumstances when women suddenly feel authorized to complain about unruly male desire, but they don't feel authorized to talk openly about unruly female desire. Mm. So under these circumstances, I'm concerned that the emphasis on unruly male desire can become a way to funnel eros. So you have situations like the one that I describe in the book, where a young woman complains in a public forum about how her partner won't go down on her. And she describes it as harassment. So this is a very poignant picture of what happens when you haven't been allowed to talk about what you want to talk about, what you want sexually. You know it's not allowed, but you've understood that it's okay to talk about male harassment. So you have to sneak it in. You have to disguise it, as it were. And so there's a way in which we could also read some of these complaints as a channel for women's disallowed desire, women's mourning. I don't mean to make the complaints non-legitimate. They're fully legitimate.
Sure.
But only to say that if we read closely into them and pass them, then we see women's desires and stories sort of just behind that. And I'd rather get those out into the open than only hear about how terrible men have been.
You know, your reference to the stories behind the scene and this woman who spoke in a public forum about her sexual encounter in unusual detail. Mm-hmm. I was reminded of many years ago, a patient who was a very loud feminist and was one of the original New York actresses in the vagina monologues. And mm-hmm. Over the course of her analysis, she was able to become aware that, in fact, she was entirely inhibited to say the word vagina in the analytic office. That public bravado was a screen for her to make sense of something that was very confusing, that was very conflictual, that in fact revealed a very active sexual history that was almost entirely dissociated and forgotten. So the specialness of your book is that you can speak to the manifest and also have access to the latent content, which is what brings us to your patient, Agni. The woman who received the diagnosis of hysteria. Mm-hmm. And why don't you start us off by telling us a bit about her, and then we can read a little bit about how the treatment went.
Yeah. When I met Agni, she was maybe 28. She had arrived at my office with an actual written diagnosis of hysteria. Mm-hmm. Assigned by her local male psychiatrist, which I found mildly amusing, also horrifying. And she had a prescription for an antipsychotic because the complaint with which she had entered the psychiatrist's office was a complaint that her husband articulated and that she shared, is that she was deeply, deeply suspicious to the point of paranoia that he was having an affair. So maybe I can read a little bit
Sure.
Agni spent several years of therapy mourning her circumstances and her conservative in-laws. So she lived with her husband's parents, fairly typical for a young woman of her age and background, which is a fairly conservative Gujarati family. She spent several years mourning her circumstances, but there was always something within her that acknowledged that it was her also who compulsively bent and submitted to these circumstances and in particular her in-laws' wishes. So the wishes of her conservative in-laws that she railed against, simultaneously she admitted in the course of her therapy that she couldn't help but follow them because it pleased her to please them. She spent a lot of time in grief, and what these years meant to her, I cannot say for sure, but over time she seemed to tire of complaining. And as her grief reduced, she began to speak more frankly of her sexual imagination. So I had suggested to Agni that her outrage and her suspicion against her husband were placeholders for her own desire. And over time, several years into the work, she started to have greater clarity about her own sexual wanderings and more precisely what she would like to do for work, so this other piece of Eros, what she could do in the world. She still couldn't bring herself to do it, and the kind of sexual paranoia that she had, the rage against her husband, the self-beatings, she had this experience of self-beatings, these had continued for some years, but they fell away entirely as she became familiar with her own adulterous psyche and its longings. Now, she never enacted these longings, but she found that imagining and articulating her desires eventually was less tiresome, and less tiring than displacing and enacting them onto others. So these memories and wishes sit more comfortably with her now as snapshots of her history rather than as disturbing photographs that have to be ejected. A year and a half after Agni's psychotherapy ended, I heard from her that she had gone on to start the life that she had so often stalled herself, and that she was now running the small business that she always dreamed about. And this really reinforced for me the idea that reclaiming sexual agency gives women an advantage inside and outside of the bedroom. It allows them the opportunity, if they wish, to combine external world power with mobility and sex appeal, as if these were all one thing, as they are for many privileged men. Disowned sexual agency is tiring, and one has to make use of others, as Agni did with her husband, to find expression for Eros. But the advantages of women's sexual agency are not easily claimed, and denial and dissociation from one's own sexual drive still offers solid psychological rewards in society more than does the ownership of sexual agency.
That last sentence is so central to what you have found to be important. Denial and dissociation from one's own sexual drive still offer far more solid psychological rewards in society than does ownership of sexual agency. You know, in the States here, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, in the past numbers of years now, most of what's written about in the analytic literature is not about sexuality. Sexuality is sort of dismissed as an epiphenomena, whereas the bedrock is the pre-Oedipal maternal attachment. Mm-hmm. And if after that's worked through, you do or don't get to the triangular sexuality or imaginary sexual, whatever you want to call it, valued, respected, seen as vital in one's development. Now, everything you've written in this book is from a different point of view. And how do you make sense of that?
Well, of course, one way of thinking about this is that post-sexual revolution countries have a different set of priorities. Mm-hmm. I think the other piece of it might be that there's a certain universality about the pre-Oedipal period. And the kinds of concerns around sexuality that women in my psychotherapy clinic and in the interviews, the kinds of concerns that they were describing were very much about cultural injunctions that got enacted in the family at adolescence. Now, adolescence, and this is another reason I think for the difference, adolescence is a new phenomenon in India. If you look at accounts written by psychotherapists, you know, even 15 years ago, 2007, there's a work on the Indians, which speaks about the Indian adolescent experience is substantially different from the experience that one sees in the West. And where the difference is that this idea of rebellion and wanting to assert individual difference is not quite the same. There's much more of a wish to stretch the bonds away from the parents, but not to break them. And I think that's this idea of Indians and this construction that we see in so many Indians of wanting to keep a connection to the group changes things a bit for us here, particularly with reference to adolescent sexuality and the emergence of it.
Thank you for that. That's an important important distinction that I certainly hadn't known. There's so much more we could talk about. It was really a challenge for me to select those quotes because we could go on. There is something at the end of your book that you mention. It's literally in the last two pages, which interested me because it's a powerful new phenomena. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. You call it scrooping, S-C-R-O-O-P-I-N-G.
Oh, yeah.
And tell us about your meeting these two midwives from a Northern California hospital who came to meet you in India to learn about this. Give us a little bit of the story, because I'm sure it will fascinate our listeners as it did me.
Yes, that was indeed so curious. I think it was around 2014, but I had a visit from two midwives who worked in a hospital in Northern California, I think Redwood City or thereabouts. And they were on this funded research project to travel to a couple of hospitals in Gujarat. Because they themselves worked at a hospital in Northern California where they were almost 30% of the patients were Indians. And the women, the Indian women who were coming in for treatment at this hospital for OBGYN treatment, had alerted these midwives to a phenomena called scrooping. And scrooping is a way of getting pregnant without sexual intercourse. It involves the woman taking her husband's semen and herself inserting it into her vagina until it reaches the uterus. And this was, the midwives explained to me that this was a popularly talked about method of getting pregnant. Now, I was fascinated by this because it seemed to have a lot of potential for what could be happening imaginatively for the women. Mm. The midwives, of course, were doing these groups in which they sort of tried to get the women to have sex with their husbands. They were encouraging them to attempt this because they thought that it would help their intimacy. And I just thought my take on it was that in refusing to have sex with their husbands, were the women asserting themselves in some way? And in choosing to get pregnant literally by their own hand, were they experiencing some feeling of power? It seemed to me that that was the case, and that I didn't want to quickly return them to intimacy with their husbands, knowing that many of them were most likely in situations that they wouldn't want to divorce or to complicate their marital relationship. And yet they might like to become mothers, especially given the kind of power that mothers hold in the Indian imagination. So I thought this was fairly creative. I also thought it opened up the possibility for whom the father was in the imagination. So we don't think perhaps enough about this. But if you have the semen in your hand and you're inserting it into your own body, you also have the potential for a fantasy at play as to whose semen it is. And so I find this quite fascinating, and these actions of the women assertive not purely problematic as the midwives had experienced it.
Your sense is that this behavior has meaning as opposed to simply pathology.
Yeah.
And your interest, tell me if I have this right, was in helping these individuals understand and consider the meanings, potentially with the possibility that if, for example, they wanted to do it themselves, that that might open up a story in the marriage in general about what it means to have mature dependency on each other and rely on each other for the things that we can do for each other, and could give them more options, but not if you go the route of pathology.
Yes. I think pathology and kind of a quick fix it, well, not quick, because the midwives...
No, there's no quick.
Yeah, they were being kind enough to sort of find out more about it.
Yeah,
but
sure.
I think it's worth thinking about what self-insemination has, what meaning it has in the, first of all, in the Indian imagination. So mythologically, we have the story of Ganesha, who's born from his mother's own hand. And, you know, in the story, it's described as soap scum, which we can imagine looks quite a bit like semen. But she impregnates herself and she produces this child. So there's a kind of a story about it that's a bigger picture story that I wonder if it might hold a kind of fascination for women. And the particular women that were under consideration, locked into family systems that they didn't want to leave, community situations that were important to them, so, you know, how to handle the priority of belonging and of staying in the group along with an imaginary lover or a dislike for a husband. I feel these kinds of enactments shed light upon that. So we shouldn't quickly imagine that what they want the most is to repair their intimacy with the husband, and that's the most mature thing to do. We might have to slow down and explore what else they've missed on the timeline towards that maturity.
Your thoughtfulness about this, which tends to be an evocative story. It's a new phenomena that most, I think, will not have heard of. And the temptation is to engage it without the thoughtfulness that you're bringing to it. It really characterizes your book in general. Again, the book is called Women's Sexuality and Modern India in a Rapture of Distress. It's been a real pleasure for me to learn about you, your work, and the culture you open up for the reader, because it is both similar and different from what Westerners are more acquainted with, and the whole psychoanalytic world in India is yet to be fully shared with the West, and hopefully these conversations can answer some of the questions that many of us have and have had no place to turn for answers. So thank you. Thank you for your writing and for agreeing to be here and for teaching us all.
Thanks to you also, Harvey, for holding the difference so richly. I appreciate that very much.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.